This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
There's no need to say shit, you already know. The question is just how far will this go? How far will he take it, and when will he stop? Shady man, and I told you once, homie, to ease up. But you just won't listen, will you? Nah, I guess not. You just can't, can you? Man, I can't stand you. You're rotten, what you plotting for us? Man, when are you gonna let up? I guess things are gonna get much worse, but they get better. Holy Toledo.
Place to be nation, listeners, you are listening to the hard-traveling fanboys, the longest-running weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Including Place to Be Nation Pop, of which we're a proud member. I am Greg Phillips. That other voice you hear on the line is Nick Duke. We are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Yep.
Welcome to another edition. Nick, how are you doing on this fine evening?
Fair. Decent. Not too shabby.
Wish I could say the same. I'm just doomed at this point, I think. But nonetheless, we soldier on, and
as I said last week, David Sunday like overreaction to potential health problems. And on that note, a very happy birthday to the Jingle Meister himself.
That's right, David Sunday, who this week turned the ripe old age of, well, we'll leave it to him to determine that, but he turned a ripe young age,
The thing to remember, Greg, is you're only as old as you feel, and he feels like he's about 62, so we're going to go with 62.
That's right, we're going to go with 62. Good point. We do wish a happy birthday to him and to any other listeners out there that may have a birthday this week. We are here to bring you an edition of the Long Book Hunters, a long-awaited edition of the Long Book Hunters that we've kind of kicked around for a couple weeks trying to get around to finding a way to read it. So, but we have done it. We've read our book this week. We've done our due diligence.
We sure have, Stevie.
We are here to provide the sugar of the Maki,
if you will.
What's that, you might ask? Well, I don't know, but we are here to review Frank Miller and Lynn Varley's The Dark Knight Strikes Again. We've been talking about doing this one for a few weeks now, Nick, and finally got around to doing it.
We did. You know, I had read the book before. It had been a little while, but about a year and a half, 2 years since I had last read it, but let's just say that it certainly lived up to my memory of it, and whether, you know, as we will discuss over the remainder of this part of the show, that memory was not exactly a positive one.
Yes, there's a certain phrase that comes to mind that one could use if one wanted to describe this story. It's right on the tip of my tongue, Nick. Do you know what I'm?
Oh, it's, you know, I think it's somewhat unique.
Yes, somewhat of a unique situation. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Now, as we like to do a little bit before we get into the discussion of the actual topic at hand, we'll give you a little background on this. Frank Miller and Lynn Varley, along with Klaus Janson, I believe. Mm-hmm. Perhaps he wasn't in on that one, but I think he was, yeah. Brought us in 1985 the legendary story, The Dark Knight Returns. Or was it 86, Nick? I can't remember. But I think it's 85. But yeah, anyway, in either 85 or 86, they gave us the seminal classic The Dark Knight Returns, which, as you know, it's been covered by far more brilliant minds than ours, and it really, really changed the game in superhero comic. It certainly changed Batman irrevocably. 1986, by the way. It changed Batman irrevocably. It changed the superhero genre.
Genre.
Genre, indeed. And like any book in the genre, it has plenty of its champions, some detractors, but most people, at the very least, even if it's not their cup of tea, will admit how influential and important and valuable The Dark Knight Returns is to the medium.
Right. I mean, it's unquestionably one of the most iconic stories in the history of the character. And like you said, it's one that kind of shaped the way DC was going to handle the character for many, many years to come. You know, and that's interesting for a book that was firmly set outside the accepted DC continuity of the time. So it was an interesting approach to Batman. It's one that I still hold, near and dear to my heart. DC did an animated full-length feature of it, the first full-length adaptation they had done to that point, being that they pretty much adapted it. You know, every page was there for the most part. They did it as two separate 72-minute movies, and then they released an ultimate edition that you could put together for one big, long, full-length adaptation of The Dark Knight Returns. And it's clear that, you know, this book, whether you're a champion of it or a detractor of it, it certainly has earned a place in comics history. And I myself, like I said, big fan of The Dark Knight Returns. I'd put it, you know, easily in my top 10 Batman stories of all time, just, you know, off the top of my head, probably in my top 5.
Yeah, unquestionably a hugely influential, a wonderful story that I feel like holds up to this day. And in light of our current society that we're in now, probably has more relevance than you'd expect from. Mm-hmm. Fast forward a few years, and Frank Miller, who was writing on Top of the World in the mid-80s, took a step back. He rebelled against the lack of creator rights in comics and kind of stepped away from DC and Marvel for a long time and did his own thing and did Sin City, of course, did 300, things like that.
I think Ronin was around that time period as well.
Ronin was before all that. Ronin was like early 80s. And so he did all this stuff and this very well-received stuff. But then as the 90s went on, Frank kind of, I guess, faded a little bit from the public eye. He went to Hollywood and tried his hand at being a screenwriter, had some bad results there, bad experiences there. Well,
direct at one point as well?
He did, but that was after the fact. He directed The Spirit, which is a movie I've
not
seen.
He wrote RoboCop 3. He directed The Spirit. That's right.
That's correct. Yeah. Yep. So, let's fast forward all the way to December 2001, and that's the first issue of The Dark Knight Strikes Again came out. This had been announced the year before that this was going to happen. 2000, I believe, is when they announced this, and people were stoked for it. People were pumped for it. It was, you know, the long-awaited follow-up to one of the greatest comic books of all time. How was Frank Miller going to follow it up? Well, for starters, the inker on Dark Knight Returns, Klaus Janson, did not return for Dark Knight Strikes Again. So instantly there was one change. You might not think would make a big impact, but as we'll get into, it may have made a big impact. Lynn Varley, the colorist, and Frank Miller's, I believe, wife or girlfriend at the time, came back and did this one as well. But this picks up some undetermined amount of time after the events of Dark Knight Returns. Nick, is it ever made clear to you how much time has passed between Returns and Strikes Again?
I thought at one point there was a reference to it having been 3 years, but I could completely be wrong about that.
Well, lots changed in the 3 years.
A great deal has changed. Apparently, Superman's defeat at the hands of Batman at the end of The Dark Knight Returns has emasculated him in such a massive, massive way.
Yes. Superman has gone from being a puppet of Ronald Reagan, essentially, to now being a puppet of the new president of the United States, who is himself a literal puppet of Superman's two biggest foes, Lex Luthor and Brainiac, who are now essentially whipped Superman into submission by threatening to take away the Bottle City of Kandor and kill them. So these two villains are basically pulling the strings of Superman and allowing him to continue to operate secretly as long as he doesn't try to stop them or do anything to help the public, which is being essentially dumbed down and controlled by the government.
Yes, through the means of various media subterfuge and whatnot.
Yes,
as we are reminded ad nauseum throughout this story.
As you know, if you've ever read Dark Knight Returns, one of the
framing devices of the entire story.
Right, framing devices, and one of the things that was very, predictive of what was to come in America was the usage of the talking heads on on television throughout the Dark Knight Returns. They would pop up and use it to frame the story and give context to the world, and it was brilliant, and it was wonderful. Well, you know that old saying, there's never too much of a good thing? Sometimes there is, because in this case, Frank decided to go back to that well, which is fine, and show how – I think it was intentional that he wanted to show how much things had spiraled out of control from where they were.
The idea, I think, was to parallel how much we are – or how much – even in 2001, you know, people were being bombarded with a constant – stream of never-ending news content. You know, the advent of the 24-hour news network, or not really the advent of it, but the explosion in popularity of the 24-hour news network in the years since The Dark Knight Returns, and then, of course, the emergence of the internet as a source for your news information. And Miller was seemingly trying to parody all of these various media outlets at the same time. And in order to do that, it means he has to take the quotient, the percentage of talking head usage that there was in Dark Knight Returns, and approximately, I'm not even exaggerating, Greg, I feel like it was almost 10 times as much as it was in Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah, no, it's all over the place. It's on every page, in every chapter, throughout the entire book. And
oh, and by the way, Greg, confirmed, the very first line of The Dark Knight Strikes Again says, and I quote, "It's been 3 years since, in the eyes of those who live above, I died. I've been very patient." So,
yes.
3 years after the events of Dark Knight Returns.
Hell of a lot's changed. Reagan's no longer in office. The puppet government has been established, apparently, over those 3 years. Very unusual, constant bombarding of these talking head sequences, basically. They cover the entire page oftentimes. And a lot of times and I know that this is the intention, but it's very confusing because you'll see just shots of people saying things and you won't know who they are or what their relevance is.
And as the story goes on, these talking heads also seemingly grow more and more characterized and less realistic, to the point where by the third issue, because this was a three-issue prestige series, much like the original Dark Knight Returns, by the third issue, they don't even closely resemble human beings anymore.
No, they actually end up looking like almost like manga characters.
Yes.
And just weirdly stylized humans. And you've got your caricatures and your which is part of the idea, I think, and there's a lot of good ideas presented here, but they're just so scattershot and they're so overpowering. And
and for every good idea, there's a couple of bad ones.
Oh, absolutely.
Is the problem.
Yeah. Well, to kind of get back to the beginning here, so to speak. When I read the first issue, I was about halfway through it, and I actually thought to myself, I actually said out loud to myself, because that's how I roll. I said, you know, this isn't half bad. This is a lot better than I was led to believe. There's some really good ideas here. But then it became apparent as the story progressed what all the problems were with it. And, how would you describe the basic premise of The Dark Knight Strikes Again, Nick?
The basic premise is, it would seem anyway, it's essentially almost trying to do a postmodern take on the Silver Age, if that makes any sense. Like, because it has some very Silver Age concepts in there, whether it's, you know, the Plastic Man and the Elongated Man playing major roles, the Bottled City of Kandor being a major factor. So it's kind of like the Silver Age, you know, filtered through that post 9/11 view, which I know the book was written prior to 9/11, but it's almost weird the way it worked out, because, you know, it feels like it was directly inspired by 9/11, even if that wasn't necessarily the case.
Right. And the ideas that are there, there are still ideas of the government oppression that were established in Dark Knight Returns, but there's also a bunch of other weird stuff here revolving around sex and identity and all kinds of things. And so Batman comes out of hiding and it basically unveils his army of Batman that he was preparing, if you recall, at the end of The Dark Knight Returns. His Bat people.
The former members of the Mutant Leader Gang, if I remember correctly.
That's right. And Carrie Kelly, who is no longer Robin. She is now, what is it, Catgirl?
Now Catgirl, with one of literally the worst superhero costume designs I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, really bad designs, which there are several in this.
And we will get to them.
And so they come out of hiding, and I don't remember exactly what they were trying to do at the beginning of the story, but...
Well, the goal at the beginning of the story was essentially to... Batman was seeking to recruit more powerful allies, because he knows that Superman and Wonder Woman, and as it's revealed later in the story, Captain Marvel, are all, you know, under the control of this new regime. And so he is seeking to find the other members of the Justice League from years gone by, who have been imprisoned by the new regime for various reasons, whether it be, I think the first one they go out and find is the Atom. They get the Flash, they get, as I said, Plastic Man and the Elongated Man. I think that's about it, from what I can recall anyway. Green Arrow is still obviously an ally of Batman, continuing his role from The Dark Knight Returns. But those are the major ones. And I will say, you know, the first one they go after, the Atom, that's probably the best sequence in the entire story, is this Atom rescue sequence, which when it first starts, you don't even realize what's going on. And by the midway point of it, you're like, oh man, what a cool concept. Because the concept essentially is that Luthor and Brainiac have taken Ray Palmer in his shrunken state and trapped him inside a petri dish with all these like bizarre viruses and stuff. So to Ray, they display as like these giant sea monsters that he's stranded in this petri dish with, and he's been there for years, and so he's got this like long, you know, Tales of the Black Freighter-esque beard, and it's like he's been abandoned in this world alone for so long.
Right.
And literally his Atom technology drops out of the sky like manna from heaven. And it's a really cool series of images and ideas, I thought.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I thought that the Atom sequence was really good. I thought there were a couple of really good sequences throughout this story. Most of them
in the first issue, though, is the problem.
Right. I would agree with that as well. I mean, I think there's a handful throughout after that, but mostly in the first issue. And mostly early in the first issue. it really starts to get scattershot at a certain point. And that's about the point when they go and get the Flash. And, okay, we talked about how cool the Atom sequence was. And there's nothing wrong with the sequence where they go and get the Flash. But let's talk a little bit about the Flash in this one. Because Batman and Carrie Kelly have, quote, modernized the Flash's costume. And when they break him out of his holding cell, where he's been used by Luthor and Brainiac to power a nuclear reactor that's powering a third of the country or whatever, when they break Barry Allen out and they give him his Flash costume, it's a new costume that's supposed to be modernized. It's a black Flash costume, black and yellow. But here's the other thing. It also does not have pants. It has shorts. 2003 Triple H-like shorts.
Yes, they are very high.
Yep,
they are very high.
They're shorts.
And what we didn't know after, you know, all these years of reading and loving the Flash, Greg, is that underneath the Flash suit, he had Robin Williams arms.
Yes, Robin Williams' arms, which goes really well with Superman's gigantic mutant hands that he has.
And his Jay Leno chin.
And his Jay Leno chin. Although Jay Leno actually pops up in the story.
He does, you know? That's true.
An uncredited cameo by Jay Leno later in the story, randomly.
Oh, I forgot to mention during the Adam sequence that Carrie Kelly swallows a naked Ray Palmer, by the way. Just in case you ever wanted to hear that sentence.
Yes. And the Flash, with his Robin Williams arms, decides to go and help Bruce with his crusade. And appears to be so fast that he can do things just across the country in the blink of a second, which is, you know, whatever. Hey, cool, whatever. We meet the Elongated Man, who is selling elongation pills.
Yes, but not in terms of giving you, you know, exactly his power set, but giving, you know, males a certain power of their own.
He's on cable television shilling out pills that can enhance performance in the bedroom using his elongation formula. So, so there's that. Who else do we meet? Plastic Man. We meet him later on. He's pretty much the same as Plastic Man's always been. He was fine. He was cool. Captain Marvel, who's now an old man, and interesting take on Captain Marvel in that instead of Captain Marvel and Billy Batson being the same person, the premise is that Billy Batson would change places with Captain Marvel. And right. At some point, Billy Batson actually died, and only Captain Marvel is left. Mm-hmm. As you know, Nick, if you kill the Captain,
all that's left is
the Marvel.
Exactly. That's a good point. That's a fantastic point. But yeah, Captain Marvel, Hal Jordan actually pops up late in the story.
Hal Jordan, who has become a green block creature, apparently.
One of the weirdest parts of it. So,
he has a green block woman wife and green block children and a green block dog.
That look like dinosaurs for some reason. Like, the whole thing doesn't make any sense. Because they talk about a couple of times throughout the story about that Hal, when the world went to hell and, you know, heroes were outlawed, just decided to leave. And I'm like, all right, I can somewhat get behind that. And obviously he's going to go off and find his own happiness or whatever. But the impression I got, Greg, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that he used his ring to create himself a family?
Maybe.
I mean, how else do you explain?
Apparently, I kind of took it as that Robert Venditti thing where he became pure will, because there's a line in there where it says,
he didn't need a battery anymore. He became a battery.
Yeah, he became one. Yeah, so maybe
he
just
still,
those willed things would himself.
Be, but those his wife and his block wife and block children would have to be constructs.
They have to be creations of him. Yeah, that's what I would assume. But yet they have distinct personalities, because they try to talk him out of going,
yeah,
or whatever, and then say,
or maybe that's just
like
maybe that's just like a manifestation of his own subconscious. Like,
I don't know. All I know is it was weird as hell.
Yes. Okay, on the one hand, it's a cool concept, because the idea is that in his old age, he's become like one of the most powerful beings in the universe. But on the other hand, it's just a really weird execution of that concept, if that makes any sense. Like,
yeah,
his wife and kid look like a cross between the blockheads from Gumby and Rex from the Toy Story movies. Like, it's a really weird combination.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then you've got the Question, who is really cool. No doubts here.
And the lettering was great for the Question, by the way. I loved how the lettering changed whenever they had his bits.
Yeah, they did a very
Rorschach's Journal
type
feel to it.
But then there's the Martian Manhunter. Go ahead.
Ooh. Yeah, no, go ahead.
The Martian Manhunter, who talks like a Brooklyn gangster for some reason.
And
he actually says, forget about it.
And has lost his powers for some reason?
He's lost his powers, and he says, forget about it. And is just a normal man now with a messed up face.
You know, the first time they showed him, before they named him, I thought it was Killer Croc.
I did too!
Like, I wasn't.
And that's
how
he talks. He talks like Killer Croc from the Suicide Squad movie.
Right, right. You would think that, like, he would. Yeah. Saturn Girl pops up for a brief moment, which should make our cohort Kelly Poole very happy.
Yes.
You don't remember Saturn Girl popping up in the story?
No, I don't.
Carrie Kelly goes to visit her for reasons I can't remember. And, you know, they do the thing with Saturn Girl where she can apparently see visions of the future. And she is talking about this new Joker that has popped up. And she keeps saying, I can't see who he is, but I can see that he hates you the most. You should be careful.
Ooh. Yes, that's right. God, who else? There's so many other characters in this that pop up. The Hawks.
The Hawks for a very... Well, was it the Hawks or was it the Children of the Hawks?
It was the Children of the Hawks, yes. Which is not
apparently,
a horror movie.
Who apparently... And I don't... Did they mention this in The Dark Knight Returns? Or are we just, like, thrown in blind here that the Hawk people of Thanagar set up their own society in the Amazon rainforest or something like that?
I didn't know about that. If that's in The Dark Knight Returns, I don't remember it.
There's just a lot going on here. It's a really scattershot, like...
Yeah.
Like Greg said, there are some cool ideas sprinkled in, but it's like idea overload almost at a certain point.
It's so much you can't process it. You really just can't process it. We also have...
And none of it really seems to fit together. It's just like a bunch of ideas that were just thrown on the page, and none of it like fits together from a cohesive narrative standpoint.
Yep. And they do kind of... They win me over by having old fat Lex Luthor...
Oh, you loved that, didn't you?
Right out of John Burns' era. However,
did he not look like Principal McVicker from Beavis and Butthead, by the way?
He did! His ugly face, too.
You could just hear him.
Oh, Beavis Superman. And Butthead. You're expelled!
I want to imagine it as Luthor and Brainiac as McVicker and Van Driesen throughout the course of the story.
Okay, Clark, we're going to make you destroy Kandor now, okay? You hear him?
You little bastard!
speaking of Brainiac, what the hell was that?
I haven't looked at the Brainiac in a while. I'd have to go back and remind myself.
Brainiac, who looks like a frog for some reason, and then on top of looking like a frog... talks and just he doesn't talk like Brainiac. He talks like a inhuman slang. Like he talks like an evil villain from like Batman the Animated Series or something. Like he's like, you're gonna listen and you're gonna listen good, see? There are certain sequences in Dark Knight Strikes Again that seem like they would have been much more appropriate in Sin City than in this story. I think particularly of a scene I think it was Luther, and it was Luther talking to one of his press secretaries, and the language that's being used, the inner monologue, no, it had to be Bruce, because it was Bruce's inner monologue, but it sounded like Hartigan from Sin City, like the inner monologue did,
right.
Like very defeatist and all that stuff, but so you could see the influence that Sin City had had on Miller's own writing. And, you know, I don't know that we've sufficiently talked about this yet. So let's go ahead and get into, in my opinion, the worst part of the story. Because I feel like
I think I know what you're going to say. Wait a minute. Okay, so there are two worst parts to the story. You go ahead with what you're
going to say. I'm going to say just the art in general.
Because the art in general is – I was just looking back at it, and I remember kind of like you know – sitting there reading the first part of it, and you're like, okay, this is fine. And it's like,
yeah,
there's this point about midway through the first issue,
yep,
where the art has been fine. Not nothing like to write home about, but it's been passable, like, you know, what you would expect from an aged Frank Miller. And then, like, halfway through the first issue, it just falls off a cliff and becomes borderline incoherent at times.
Yeah. No, you're right. It gets worse from there.
Much worse. Yeah,
it progresses. It hits its plateau in about halfway through the first issue, and then it starts going downhill really quickly. And then it hits about a – it hits like – it just falls off the ledge at a certain point and just heads straight down. And, I mean, the dimensions are off. People don't look like people.
Even some of the coloring is off to the point where it looks like they're almost coloring outside the lines of the characters at times.
It's the colors are bad. The backgrounds at times are almost non-existent. They're just blobs of – they're just blobs of – I don't know, energy or something. It's Superman's face. Oh my lord! It's all over the place. In some scenes, he's got this really clean face, and in other scenes, he looks like I don't know whoever the wrinkliest old actor is you can think of that somebody just hit them in the face with a shovel.
Like Ian McDiarmid from episode 3.
Yes.
Now listen, I am not one of those people who thinks that Wonder Woman needs to be portrayed as a large-breasted white woman pinup girl, but is this not one of the worst, like, drawn Wonder Women we've ever seen in our lives?
Yeah, that's the thing. When the news and the nude woman that he draws in there looks better than Wonder Woman, which is a rather unique situation. But everybody looks bad. Everybody in this story bad.
Yeah.
Probably the only one that isn't drawn to look like a mutated freak is Carrie Kelly. And Ray Palmer. Yeah, he's drawn pretty normally, all things considered. But everyone else is just drawn just completely bizarrely. And in some panel, and I think this is where partially the lack of Klaus Janson came in, because in some of these panels, in these pages, I don't know if you noticed this, Nick. There are pages where Batman is drawn to look like, I don't know, like a contemporary Batman, like it's 1968 again or something. And then there are other pages where Batman is drawn to look old and haggard and broken down.
All right, yeah. I mean...
It's very strange.
It's very odd. Yeah, the art here is just... is just awful. And it has a lot of white space in it, too, but I almost get the impression that it wasn't like an inventive use of white space. It was a, oh my god, we have no clue what we're doing, so let's just not do a background at all here.
Yeah.
And use of white space, you know?
I mean, the art is just...
And even some of the characters are drawn in profile, there's no depth or dimension to it. It literally looks like two-dimensional characters on the page.
Right. It's almost unreadable at certain points because of how cluttered the pages were with all of the talking heads, and B, with how just shoddily drawn everything seemed to be. And that's a shock coming from a guy like Miller, who was such a great artist in his heyday.
And when you sprinkle in what I would say is the other worst part of the book, because we briefly mentioned it, but I think we need to talk about it a little bit here.
The character.
This has to be among – and I say this as someone who has never been the world's biggest Superman fan and as someone who has only recently become a pretty, you know, big fan of Wonder Woman. But if the idea is to do DC's, you know, big three, the Trinity, through the Dark Knight Returns lens, these have to be two of the worst characterizations of Wonder Woman and Superman, respectively, I've ever read in a DC comic. It is – especially in the case of Superman, borderline insulting to fans of the
character. Oh, it is. And for the record, Nick, a lot of people feel that way about Dark Knight Returns with regards to
Okay, and I can understand that to a degree, but if I look at the Dark Knight Returns in a vacuum, I can sit there and say, okay, Superman is a stand-in for all this political oppression that Frank Miller is clearly trying to embody, you know, in the story, and I can move past it. But the idea that Superman is going to continuously be portrayed as someone who is essentially a mindless puppet. I mean, Bruce, more than once throughout the course of The Dark Knight Strikes Again, tells Clark how dumb he is, and that he's not smart enough to keep up with Bruce and all this other stuff.
Literally.
And
like,
not to mention...
Go ahead.
And not to mention the fact, in The Dark Knight Returns, like, they show you Superman and Reagan having discussions, and Superman actually giving his opinion about matters and trying to convince Reagan to do this or do that. Here in Strikes Again, it's nothing but, you know, Superman blindly bowing to the will of Lex Luthor or Brainiac, or in a lot of cases, blindly bowing to the will of Wonder Woman.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, and like I said, in Dark Knight Returns, I've always defended the use of Superman in that I can envision Superman taking the actions that he takes in the Dark Knight Returns. I've always said that, because I feel like there is also an element of, just because Bruce is the protagonist doesn't mean he's right about everything. But in Dark Knight Strikes Again, all the ambiguity is gone. Batman is right. Superman is wrong. And anyone that agrees with Superman is wrong. Not only are you wrong if you agree with Superman, you're stupid if you agree with Superman. Not only is Superman stupid, but he gets the shit beat out of him by his own girlfriend, Wonder Woman. And she slaps him around and she said, "God, I could kill you myself. Be a man." And then they have literal earth-shaking sex.
Yes, they literally break a mountain through the force of their lovemaking.
That's right. And it's just he's a cowardly character in this.
And apparently, Superman has super semen, because they have sex and Wonder Woman instantly knows that she's pregnant.
Yep, she can feel how pregnant she is. Yep. And you know, I have it on good authority that Superman sired a lot of children. But you know who else sired a lot of children, Nick?
The High Evolutionary.
The High Evolutionary. He sired a baseball team. An orchestra, if you count the bastards.
Did you know that the High Evolutionary semen can cure leprosy? I wish I had
leprosy. In any event, so Superman, he gets repeatedly told what a moron he is. He gets bossed around by the bad guys. He's willing to let people die just to protect Kandor, because he thinks there's no way.
He doesn't have a relationship with his own daughter, who is like 16, and he has never met her in his life.
Yep. It is character assassination, quite frankly.
Wonder Woman isn't much better. In the story, less, but this is a version of Wonder Woman I don't recognize.
No. It's way out of left field. It's a Wonder Woman who appears unconcerned with anything outside of herself.
Yes.
And her and Superman trying to save people discreetly while not getting on the bad side of Luthor and Brainiac. So that's bad enough. That's borderline character assassination on these icons.
Right. And so the main thrust of the story, if we haven't made it clear, is that Batman is trying to put together this team to take down the regime that has been put in place by Luthor and Brainiac. And in the course of the story, that means that Superman, Wonder Woman, and Captain Marvel, you know, get in their way. But then, about halfway through the story, they introduce a bizarre secondary threat. If you remember, in The Dark Knight Returns, that book actually featured the final encounter between Batman and the Joker, at the end of which the Joker snapped his own neck and died. Well, about the midway point of the story, about halfway through the second of three issues, we are introduced to a new version of the Joker, who is going around murdering the various costumed heroes of the DC universe. But this is a Joker who takes arrows straight to the face and, you know, is set on fire with gasoline and yet seemingly can't be killed. And so there's this kind of this building mystery throughout the course of the story of who is this Joker, how did he get these powers, and why is he targeting the various costumed heroes. You know, we mentioned before the bizarre interpretation of the Martian Manhunter. The Martian Manhunter actually meets his demise at the hands of this new Joker who just sets him on fire with a can of gasoline without much of a fight being put up by John Jones. So it's certainly a unique situation with this new Joker.
Absolutely. And, hell, can we go ahead and spoil it, Nick?
Well, I mean, I just kind of wanted to hear you, Greg. Why don't you take us through your experience with this Joker storyline in this book?
Well, I had already had it spoiled for me ahead of time, first of all. I knew who the Joker was going to end up being. And I thought, well, how is Frank going to explain it? And the answer is not very well. You see, for those of us who have read a little bit of All-Star Batman and Robin, which takes place in the Dark Knight Returns universe, and it came out after Dark Knight Strikes Again, so but it's a prequel.
Has that ever actually been confirmed, or was that just like...
Miller said it was the case.
Okay.
But
I had always read that it was like the spiritual prequel or whatever, not necessarily the... according to Miller, yeah, the series takes place in the same universe as The Dark Knight Returns. Okay. Well, it makes some modicum of sense, I suppose.
Yeah, because Batman is a raging psychopath in that.
Well, but granted, when Dark Knight Strikes Again is published, we don't have All-Star Batman. All-Star Batman and Robin does not exist unless right. you don't have any of that context.
Right. So, this kind of a little bit maybe makes sense if you read that. But if you don't read that, basically at some point in time, Batman fired the first Robin, Dick Grayson, for being a moron, for being ineffective, a loser. Well, come to find out that this supernatural evil Joker who's going around killing everybody is revealed at the end of the story to be a genetically altered version of, you guessed it, my favorite comic book hero, Dick Grayson. And he's trying to get revenge on Batman for ruining his life, ruining his childhood. He's angry. He's angry at Carrie Kelly for being Robin. And Nick, do you wanna recite the line that Bruce delivers to the Joker when he realizes who it is?
Oh, give me a minute. I got to pull it up. I want to make sure that I get this right. I mean,
you don't want to screw it up, yeah.
Such beautiful dialogue deserves accuracy. But kind of, I mean, what were you thinking, though? I want to know, Greg. I want you to don't hold back. Let's hear it.
Well, I mean, like I said, I had it spoiled in advance. So, I mean, I knew it was coming. So I wasn't, like, taken off guard or anything. But I'll just say that it was unsurprising in many ways, because for whatever reason, this is a well that Batman writers like to go to. They like Dick Grayson as the hapless victim who has to be saved by Batman, and they like Dick Grayson as the guy who wasn't good enough to fulfill the legacy of Batman. And so Frank kind of almost combines the two by having a weak-minded version of Dick Grayson, who not only fails to live up to the mantle and be able to fulfill the role of Batman, or even as Robin, but is a psychopath who becomes the most evil man in the world, the Joker.
And is essentially driven by you know, jealousy and rage, essentially.
Yep. Now, it's... It's kind of a temptation for Batman writers to want to do this Robin gone wrong story, and I guess Dick's the easiest one to do, and it's without the context of All-Star Batman and Robin, it really doesn't make sense. It just, because no interpretation, Dick doesn't even appear in Dark Knight Returns, if I remember correctly, and
no,
there's no version of Dick Grayson would ever become the Joker. Like, it's so out of left field. Now, with background of All-Star Batman and Robin, where you see how, you know, this psychopath Batman takes this young boy and physically and mentally tortures him, basically, to force him to fight his battles, it kind of becomes a little apparent how he could turn out to be a psychopath later in life himself. But as it is in the story, it's just, you know, another example of a bad usage of my favorite DC character, Nightwing. So very, very unhappy with the usage of Dick Grayson, but again, not surprised.
Yeah. So basically what happens here is you have this story, you know, this mystery of who the Joker is, and as Greg said, it kind of all builds to this ultimately somewhat anticlimactic reveal of Dick Grayson as the Joker. And, you know, it's a version of the Joker, like we said, that can't be killed, that has some sort of weird healing factor. So Bruce's idea is that he's going to bring down the entire Batcave on top of him. And so Bruce, you know, reads off this code to set a self-destruct sequence in on the Batcave. And the Joker responds by reciting what he believes to be the corresponding override code. Well, the Bat computer rejects this code, leading to this wonderful exchange that I know Greg loves so good. Batman says, and I quote, "So, it's you. I changed the abort code the night I fired you, Dick Grayson."
Mm. Mm.
And Dick says, "You were always so damn smart."
Yep.
And then Bruce says, "Yeah, when I fired your sorry butt for incompetence, for cowardice. You couldn't cut the mustard, Bunky. And did you bawl like a baby or what? You were pathetic, Dickster. You were always pathetic. You're still pathetic. And now you're pathetic and just plain weird looking."
Oh, no. Not weird looking. In a book filled with people that are weird looking. That's, good Lord, that's horrible.
And then he proceeds to call him, like, weird insults like Bobbin and Dondi and various other things.
He starts digging into, like, the mid-1800s old person parlance. "Listen here, you scalawag!"
And then he literally beheads him with a hatchet.
Boy, and people lost their minds over Batman versus Superman.
Yep. Beheads him with a hatchet, and the disembodied head of Dick Grayson continues to yell at Batman even after he's been beheaded.
Yeah. Now, the one way that scene works, though, is if you read all of Batman's lines as JR. Like,
yes, if you read them as Jim Ross, you're good.
Yeah, it's like, "Well, I changed all the codes when I fired your ass, Grayson. For incompetence, for cowardice, you son of a bitch."
Oh, Bobbin, for God's sake, Bobbin.
"For the love, are you a son of a bitch or what? You bastard.
You were useless. You didn't have the damn chops. You couldn't cut the by God mustard."
Oh, Dick Grayson, huh? Oh, that's real cute. That's real cute. I locked your short pants. What the hell happened to them, huh?"
Pathetic.
I fired your ass because you weren't good enough. Now, can you argue that? Can you disagree with that? Hell no. Mm. See, it works. But unfortunately, just reading it doesn't work.
No.
So, just another case of just bizarre character characterization here. A Batman that really doesn't seem to have much of a problem with killing. He allows the son of the Hawks to kill Lex Luthor and beheads Dick Grayson, obviously. But, you know, then at other times he has chances to do things like that and doesn't. He had a chance to kill Lex earlier in the story and had his foot in his throat and chose not to kill Lex. So that's a little all over the place. The whole thing is just all over the place, man. And like we've said, it's not all bad. There are good ideas present, but it would have been better if drawn by someone else, and they would have been better if probably stretched out maybe over the course of 5 or 6 prestige-length books instead of 3. At least 4. This needed at least 4 prestige-length books to tell the story, and it probably needed to drop 2 of the, 8 subplots that are going on.
Well, but if you expand it to 4 prestige books, then Miller has to draw 4 prestige books.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And I get the impression that part of the issue was the fact that he just couldn't. I mean,
oh, yeah,
these prestige books, Greg, they're 70 pages each. Frank Miller couldn't draw a 200-page story. It just wasn't.
Oh, no, no. That's what I'm saying. It needed to be drawn by someone else anyway. Like,
right.
That's apparent in this, is that somebody else needed to be drawing this if it was going to be a long story, because he seemed to lose steam or just try to rush it after a certain point.
Fairly early on, yeah.
Yeah. Just not good. And some of the character changes, some of the story beats don't make sense to me. The weird Brainiac fake alien invasion thing seemed kind of odd to me. It seemed like there were better ways to accomplish discrediting the superheroes than doing that. Yeah. Again, Superman just made to look completely pathetic. Batman is a psycho. Carrie Kelly is almost a cutout character in this, because she's there and she's entertaining when she's there, but you're not really sure why she's doing anything that she's doing. She has to realize how dumb or how just over the top Batman is being at times, but she just follows every order, hook, line, and sinker. Strange. Just a strange, strange book. Although she may be the best part of it. So, ultimately, wrapping things up, I've got a weird take on this, Nick, because I'm going to say I'm actually going to recommend that people should read this. Don't buy it, but get it from the library, borrow it, and read it once, because it's an experiment that I think you need to – as an experiment, it's worth reading. But it's a bad comic book, so I would give it a failing – or I would give it a below-average grade for sure, a failing grade as a publication. But I do think it was – I'm glad that I finally read it. I'll put it like that, because – now I have some context for some of the discussions about it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually kind of mirror that a little bit. I would recommend that everybody read it once just to experience it. Like, it is one of the most bizarre things you'll probably ever read. And when you view it through that prism, it's at least worth the entertainment value of seeing how badly something like this, that should have been a sure thing, can go off the rails, you know, so easily. So I would say for sheer entertainment value and absurdity, I would also recommend, you know, find it somehow, read it. Do not spend your hard-earned money on it, though.
And it's also an interesting, I guess, character study and seeing the writing tics that would become famous in All-Star Batman and Robin. You can see that transition through Dark Knight Strikes Again. You can see the arc that would lead to I'm the GD Batman just a few years later. So it's certainly interesting from that standpoint. And
that'll have to be a future long book hunt, Greg, the All-Star Batman and Robin.
Oh,
look back.
Yeah, so we can try to get our hands on the deluxe edition, maybe.
At the very least, there's Jim Lee art with that, though.
Yes, very true, very true. And also, there's... Whoop, hang on. Nick, are you getting this one?
I'm waiting with bated breath.
It says, Ho Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment. All right, that's exciting. Wow. Sorry for the time.
What are we going to do on the day, Greg, when, you know, sitting right here on the shelf in our Vancouver, British Columbian studios, right next to the Ho Ho Loon ticker is a piece of technology that, I mean, we don't even know if it works anymore.
No, we haven't changed the batteries in years.
Much like R2-D2 in Star Wars The Force Awakens, it shut down at a certain point, and it will likely never come back to its old self, but what are we going to do on the fateful day if and when the Basham's ticker ever wakes back up?
If the Basham's ticker, and yes, it's a ticker, ever wakes up again, folks, it'll be a whole new day, a whole new dawn here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Let me tell you. That day has not yet come, but if it does, Nick, it'll be a game changer.
And for Jennifer Smith, you know what happens when we make another reference that you don't get? You know what happens? It just made the list.
That's right. Drink it in, man. And stay with us through the break, ladies and gentlemen.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only feed, and of course, the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of the Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
After talk of the Basham sticker, I'm surprised that anyone has left.
That's right, that's right. Those of you who stayed, you're not on the list. So you got that going for you.
Which is nice.
So, but we are here to give you our usual segments, and let's kick things off with our little look at what we've been doing the last week. With a segment we like to call
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
That right there. And we are going to start off as usual lately. This is the last week where we will have no watching because all of our stories are coming back this week. So next week,
our stories.
Next week we'll have analyses and reviews of the mid-season comeback episodes. And but for now, we're going to go right into reading. And I have been in a bad state lately, and so I have only read two books over the last week. So Nick, how do you want to approach this?
I'll just let you talk about your two books, and then – well, no. You go ahead. So you read two books?
Yes.
All right. Well, I'll start with my number three then,
right.
And we'll go from there. Yep. So my number three book of the week is one that's a bit of a surprise just because I've never actually bought an issue of this book before. My number three is Spider-Gwen number 16. This is part two of the Sitting in a Tree storyline that features the beginnings of some sort of romantic entanglement between Miles Morales and the Gwen Stacy of Earth 36, I think? Whatever Earth it is, the Spider-Gwen Earth. And I don't know anything about the universe that Spider-Gwen lives in, but I will say this book makes me want to learn more. It seems to be an interesting place where Matt Murdock is evil and just all kinds of weird things are going on around here. It got me intrigued. But mainly, I love the way that Jason Latour wrote this dynamic between these two characters. It was for someone who has only ever been used to reading Miles Morales through the lens of Brian Michael Bendis, I didn't even realize that it wasn't Bendis writing it. That's how natural it felt. I absolutely loved the hell out of this book, and it was pretty as hell. Lots of good things to say about this Spider-Gwen book, and we got four more issues of this story to go, so I'm very excited to read the rest of the storyline and see what the future is of these two characters as a couple.
Who draw it, Nick?
I believe it's Robbie Rodriguez.
Oh, good.
Or it's somebody named Rodriguez. I think it's Robbie.
Not Ronnie Rodriguez?
No, and that one just made the list as well.
Ah, excellent. Very good.
So moving on to your number two book of the week.
My number two book of the week would be Green Arrow number 10, Murder on the Empire Express Part 1. My idea this week was to try and catch up on Green Arrow, but I did not have time or energy to do it. But this is a really good issue. Ben Percy and that Juan Ferreira on art, and really, really good. Great characterizations of Ollie and Dinah and Diggle. An intriguing concept that kind of went actually against what I was expecting it to be going in. Very promising storyline seems to be kicking off here. I thought this was significantly better than issues 7 through 9 of the series. So Green Arrow number 10 appears to be back on track for what looks to be a really compelling storyline.
Moving on to my number two, I've got Green Lantern's number 15. This is a one-parter, a one-off called A Day in the Life. And essentially, this is a book almost entirely about Jessica Cruz. And the idea is her kind of explaining to the reader that her greatest battle, you know, it isn't when Atrocitus shows up, or it isn't, you know, when the Phantom Lantern is attacking, or it isn't doing any of the things she has to do as a member of the Justice League. The greatest battle she fights each and every day is finding the willpower to get up out of bed and not let fear and anxiety rule her life and keep her in her bedroom all day. It's a really cool look at how the topic of anxiety can be handled in the context of a superhero universe. I absolutely love this. For anybody who has enjoyed Jessica Cruz to this point, during her existence as a character, I kind of feel like this might be the high point. It is a wonderful, fascinating character study for her. And it just goes to show you that, like I've been saying, this Green Lantern franchise is in solid hands once again.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. I've got all these issues. I just need to catch up on them. I'm still on the Phantom Lantern story, but yeah, I'm really digging it. And it's awesome to hear that the Green Lantern line is firing on all cylinders. Speaking of which, my number one book that I've read this past week is, again, a months-old title, but it is Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 7 by Robert Venditti and Rafa Sandoval. And this is a book that just floored me with how good it was. It was a big knockdown, drag-out fight between Hal Jordan and Sinestro that's kind of been building since the Rebirth issue of this book. And you see all these – everybody gets these big moments. Sorenik Natu rescues Guy Gardner from the Fear Engine. John leads the Corps to what he thinks is going to be an all-out assault on Warworld, only to find Sorenik and a quote, good – segment of Yellow Lanterns instead of who they're expecting, which is Sinestro and his minions. And Hal and Sinestro seemingly fade away and classify themselves as obsolete at the end of the issue. So really compelling stuff, very well drawn, very well written. Robert Venditti, man, hats off to how he's writing these characters. He's doing a great job of returning some of or a lot of the fun and the sense of adventure that was always present in the Geoff Johns era. So really big fan of this book.
Absolutely. Moving on to my number one book of the week, and I don't really want to say too much about it from a plot standpoint because it's got some big-time revelations for these two characters here and that I don't want to give away for our compatriot, my co-host, Mr. Phillips. But my number one book of the week is Batman number 15. This is the second part of the rooftop storyline, and this, finally, after weeks of promises, reveals what the ultimate truth of Catwoman's alleged murder of 237 people was. Now, it is up to each individual reader whether you find this explanation sufficient. I personally did find it sufficient. Not to mention, I thought the book was expertly drawn by Mitch Grads, and of course, very well written by Tom King. And I just want to call out the closing dialogue of this issue. And now, I'm not going to spoil anything about the reveal, Greg, for you. But I just want to highlight this final exchange between Alfred and Bruce and how beautiful it is. And it opens with a little bit of voiceover of Bruce saying, "She took it, Alfred, as if it belonged to her, as if it always belonged to her. She stole it." And then Alfred says, "I'm sorry, Master Bruce, I did not quite understand. I obviously conducted a detailed inventory after Miss Kyle left us. Everything appeared, surprisingly, to be in order. What then did she steal, sir?" And you see Bruce grimace and like look downtrodden and slowly pick up the cowl, and as he puts it back on, he says, "The night, Alfred, the night. She stole the night." And the book ends. And it is, man, it's beautiful. Loved the hell out of this book, and I have a feeling you're going to as well, Greg.
Very good. Very, very good. Looking forward to it. But that leads us into your bottom book of the week, Nick, correct?
Yeah, sure. You know, once again, a week where, you know, a lot of pretty good books, but if I want to pick a bottom, I'm going to go with Trinity number 5. This is a series that I've had high praise for a long time. But I'm going with it as my bottom book of the week for a couple reasons this week. One, this is the first issue of the book where I feel like the chore of writing and drawing one title by yourself is starting to get to Francis Manapul. The art starts to slip a little here. It's still very good art, but it's not up to the standard of the first four issues. But more importantly, it features a rather bizarre subplot involving Mongol seemingly somehow willing a child into existence in a dream world, but then the child can actually leave the dream world in some kind of Freddy Krueger-like transformation. It's a really, really weird plot. That I don't fully understand, and it also ties pretty heavily, apparently, into that Poison Ivy miniseries they did a few months back, which I'd never read, so I was very lost as to what the whole dynamic between Poison Ivy and this Mongol dream child was. So, mainly because I was confused during a lot of it, and because the art slipped a little bit, I'm going with Trinity number 5 as my bottom book of the week.
Awesome, and now, well, not awesome, I guess, but another book I need to catch up on. But let's get to your quick hits.
Sure. Dr. Aphra number 3 continues to be a highly entertaining read. Once again, 000 and BT steal this damn book pretty much every single issue. Green Arrow number 15 continues to be a very, very solid Green Arrow storyline. I'm loving the hell out of this, and I love the emotional vulnerability that Oliver shows in this issue. The Deluge, number 15, or Aquaman, number 15, excuse me, the final part of the Deluge. Fantastic story, an emotional confrontation between Aquaman and Black Manta, and a new status quo for Aquaman, including a surprising decision he makes at the end of the book that actually highlights his ability to be both a leader of his people and a hero, even if it isn't always doing, you know, the easy thing. Superman number 15, the second part of the Multiplicity storyline. This is cosmic, silver agey, weird out there Superman storytelling in the best possible way. the Superman of all of the multiverse coming together to battle this mysterious foe. And it's this kind of stuff you can only really do in a, like, early 80s inspired Superman story. I know I just said Silver Age, but it's joyful is the best way I can describe it. It's a hell of a book. Justice League versus Suicide Squad number 5, as we barrel towards the conclusion of this six-part crossover, we get to see the ultimate evil of the book, the ultimate villain of the piece, finally revealed in all their glory. And I'm very intrigued to see how they wrap this one up. Gonna be interesting to see how the squad could possibly take down a now warped version of the Justice League. And finally, I've got Justice League of America, The Ray Rebirth, number 1. This is the latest in the series of one-shots that are introducing us to the characters who are going to make up the Justice League of America. And once more, you know, doesn't reinvent the wheel. It isn't going to be mind-blowing or anything, but I think it's a very, very solid introduction to the character of the Ray, much like the Vixen and the Vixen and the Atom one-shots were preceding it. So I continue to be impressed by Steve Orlando and intrigued by what he's going to be able to bring to this new Justice League title.
Very good. You still haven't given me your thoughts yet on IDW's Jake and the Fat Man number 1.
That's because it doesn't exist, Greg.
Oh. I see. Well, this is embarrassing.
I hate to disappoint you.
In any event, I had detailed thoughts on it, but let's carry on. Apparently it was in my dream world. But let's move.
Well, if you're anything like the Mongol dream child, you can pull it out of the dream world and into the real world. So don't give up hope just yet.
But let's move from reading and watching, and let's get on to our other weekly segment. You all know what it is.
Welcome to the Rundown. Doodle-doo-doo-doo. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown. Doodle-doo-doo-doo. Where we talk about movies too.
That's right. Listen to that squealing guitar in the background. I wonder who... Wonder who made that guitar noise with his mouth. Must be a pretty talented fellow there. Huh? Must be decent. Yeah, that's right, folks. We're ready for the rundown, your weekly rundown of news and notes from around the comic book world. And we're going to get right into it with confirmation of a rumor that's been out there for quite a while in the world of television. And that is that – animated –
film.
Direct-to-video movies.
So. No, theatrical movies. Theatrical. Understanding.
Okay, well.
Yes.
Sony's animated Spider-Man movie is going to be a Miles Morales movie. This is confirmed this week. This has been a rumor for quite a while, but this is going to focus on the Brian Michael Bendis creation, Miles Morales. And this is a pretty big deal. Miles has never been featured in his own property before. So this will be a big deal. What are your thoughts, Nick?
Obviously, I'm excited. Phil Lord, who co-wrote the Lego Movie and is also I can't remember what his exact role with it is, but he's also heavily involved with the Star Wars Han Solo. yes, that's right, Han Solo standalone film that's coming up in a couple years. Wrote the script for this and. This exists outside of the current Sony-Marvel partnership, which means that so while the live-action Spider-Man movies are now part of the MCU, this is going to stand alone in its own universe, and it's going to feature Miles Morales. Now, the one part that kind of makes me wonder, Greg, does this mean that perhaps as part of the deal between Sony and Marvel that Sony or Marvel got Peter back and Sony retained their rights to Miles Morales in this scenario? Does this possibly mean that in the future it's highly unlikely we'll see Miles in the MCU?
I don't know. That's a good question, Nick. That's a strong question. I don't have the answer to it. But I would I think a lot of that answer will be – or a lot of those questions will be answered when this movie is closer to coming out, because I think if it has any tie or mention to the other Spider-Man, then we'll know that it's a shared character. And if it completely ignores Peter Parker and the other Spider-Man, then, you know, Miles will probably be exclusive to the Sony Studios world for a while anyway. And yeah. I mean, honestly, we're so far off from when Miles could even appear in the MCU right now because of how young Peter is.
Right.
That there's really no point in even thinking about it right now. I mean, by the time 2022 or 23 rolls around, then, you know, this will be a moot point. Because let's face it, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't expect that this is going to be a huge box office hit. I think it'll be a good movie. But, I mean,
theatrical. It depends on how it's marketed. You know, if it's if it's an animated movie marketed towards kids, those always clean up at the box office. You
true.
Know, it's a matter of what kind of movie they're setting out to make. If they're setting out to make a fairly standard superhero movie that just happens to be animated, then obviously I think there are some concerns there. But if they set out to make a more kid-friendly, you know, something more in the vein of the Despicable Me movies or whatever that have been, you know, massive hits, I think you could see a pretty massive return on this one. Also, by the way, I just want to say for the record, it currently has a release date of December 21st, 2018. I'd be highly surprised if it stayed on that date, seeing as how December, that's right around the time that Star Wars has now taken over for their annual release.
Yep.
So I would be stunned if that movie actually is released on that date. But that's a ways down the road.
Yeah. You might even be rock bottomed if that happens.
One can only hope.
Who wouldn't want to be, right?
Right.
But we'll get to that a little bit later. But, you know, you talked about, you know, maybe aiming the movie towards kids. Well, one movie that's not going to be aimed towards kids,
even though it has a kid in it,
is the upcoming Hugh Jackman film, Logan. Because we got news this week that it has been rated R by the MPAA for, quote, strong, brutal violence and language throughout, and for brief nudity. Now, the most important part of that, of course, is the brief nudity of Hugh Jackman's ass, most likely.
I'm assuming it's old senile Professor X forgetting to wear pants.
That could be as well. But most importantly of all, strong, brutal violence.
Yes.
I am in favor of this. I want a Wolverine movie with strong, brutal violence, and I'm going to get a Wolverine movie with strong, brutal violence.
And we even got a little glimpse at it with the release this week of the latest trailer, especially the red band version of said trailer, which featured some pretty awesome moments of Wolverine and the character that appears to be X-23 beating some ass, as it were.
Oh. Amazing. If you haven't watched the Red Band Logan trailer, go do so right now because it's awesome. And it includes the mother of all unexpected F-bombs at the very end of it.
Yes.
Just masterful from a Slayton character you would not expect to hear it from. Yeah, this trailer was awesome, Nick. Can we agree that so far, at the very least, Logan is winning the trailer game for the 2017 superhero movies?
I would agree that it's right there, because I think you couldn't be any more different in terms of the two movies. But that last Guardians trailer was pretty fucking awesome in its own right.
It was.
You know, Big Dave bringing it with the humor and Baby Groot having awesome scenes and stuff. So. Completely opposite ends of the spectrum, so to speak, but those two, Logan and Guardians, would be the ones I would say, you know, these are the movies that are right now providing a masterclass in how to cut a trailer.
Oh, God, I know that. Logan just looks and feels so much different than anything we've seen before in the genre.
And that I will absolutely agree with. But, you know, to make a transition from Logan on the big screen, Greg, why don't we move over to a story on the small screen that also involves the X-Men franchise, as according to a report, that unnamed X-Men drama that has been bandied about over at Fox has received an official pilot order, and they're going to get a pilot overseen by Burn Notice showrunner Matt Nix, according to the Hollywood Reporter. And that report goes on to say that while FX's upcoming Legion is not connected to the X-Men films, this Fox drama will fit squarely into the movies and will feature, quote, familiar characters. Greg, your reaction to this news?
Oh, I'm stoked. I mean, I have always believed that, special effects withstanding, the X-Men lent themselves to a television series format. I think it's obvious if you study the characters, if you study the history of the franchise, it's always been a serial type story. And the X-Men at its best is a grand soap opera. And I think that there's always been room to explore that kind of a format with these characters. It's just been a matter of getting the special effects where they need to be and finding the right kind of story, which, according to this article on Newsarama, the premise of the show is basically there are parents that are on the run from the government because they find out that their children are mutants. And, I mean, that's a classic X-Men conceit.
I just wonder how long you can carry that as the focus of the show. Because at some point, you're going to have to bring in a regular revolving cast of characters, and I would assume some of those are going to have to be, you know, characters that are familiar to us, rather than whoever these parents and
well, I have a couple thoughts on that, Nick. Yes. First of all, I would say that you can make the traveling format work. I mean, it worked for the Incredible Hulk for many years. You know, you have your central characters, your whoever's chasing them will be a central character, and then the two of them and the kids. But I think that in this case, they could easily make the two characters in question Cyclops and Phoenix.
An aged version of those who have a kid?
Yep. They could even do like a futuristic Age of Apocalypse type story with them, where they're on the run protecting their kids. Or they could do... you know, they could have the kid be a familiar X-Men character that's going to grow up to become, you know, something special, as Lou Holtz might say.
Yeah, my hope for it ultimately would be that perhaps it could be a Kitty Pride-focused show, but I know that's unlikely to happen.
Ooh, and they could tie it into the movie that way. Oh, man, I like the way you think. Thinking.
Well, that's just my Bendis fanboyism coming out, given his obsession with Kitty Pryde.
Of course, we have already had a movie version of Kitty Pryde.
Yes, we have had a movie version of Kitty Pryde in the most technical of senses, I suppose.
Wow. Shots fired at Ellen Page.
I'm not firing shots at Ellen Page. I am firing shots at the role and dialogue that was written for Ellen Page in especially X3 The Last Stand. And, of course, she was fine in her cameo in Days of Future Past, but I would like to see something with a little bit more meat on the bone, so to speak, for Kitty Pryde, who, you know, granted, I'm not the X-Men aficionado that you are, but she's always been one of my favorite X-characters.
And appropriately enough, let's swing on from the small screen and go right back to the big screen, because some news came out from the DC film slate. As we found out, you know, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about the Shazam movie. The Rock signed a contract to play Black Adam, Shazam's most famous foe, Captain Marvel's most famous foe, a couple years ago, or a year ago at least, and there still hasn't really been much movement on the movie. It still doesn't have a script, although it does now have a writer. We found out that there is a writer attached to it, whose name escapes me at this time. He's the guy that wrote Earth to Echo.
Henry Gayden is writing the film.
Henry Gayden, yes, and he wrote the movie Earth to Echo, which I've never seen, but it seems like an appropriate, tonally similar movie to what a Captain Marvel movie might
be. Yeah, I mean, well, a Shazam movie needs to be a kid superhero. There is no reason to not make a kid focused, you know, child friendly superhero movie with Shazam.
And they don't. They definitely don't need to like have it with like really gray hues to everything.
No, bright, colorful, bombastic, a little over the top.
Bombastic and bodacious. Yeah. But that's a deep cut even by my standards. The point being, what we found out this week is that Shazam is still being planned, but The Rock is actually also going to be playing in his own spin-off movie, a follow-up to Shazam, known as Black Adam. So after Shazam, or actually it says it will be developed simultaneously to the Shazam film, and we don't know who's writing Black Adam yet, but it's going to be a solo, standalone film starring Black Adam. And I know some people have been questioning this, saying, oh, do we really need a Black Adam movie? And I would say yes. Yes, we do, because it's the freaking Rock, for one thing. And for another thing, Black Adam was legitimately a top five or six DC character in the mid-2000s. From about 2005 through about 2011 with the reboot, Black Adam was a legit top 10, maybe top five DC character, thanks to Geoff Johns. Thanks to the 52 series, it'll work. And there's some great angles to do with Black Adam if people delve into the source material.
Indeed, you know, I am excited. Don't get me wrong. I am looking forward to seeing what comes of this. However, let me play a little devil's advocate for a moment, Greg. This mm-hmm. is a movie that has not – Shazam is a movie that has not even really officially gone into production. They are just now writing right. a script. And they are doing what I think is a little bit of the Warner Brothers thing, where they are already under the assumption that this is going to be well-received, and they are planning for a spinoff before they've ever even cracked the story on the original. Does this not seem a little bit like – greenlighting Green Lantern 2 back in 2011 before Green Lantern was ever released?
Oh, yes. I definitely feel where you're coming from. I think maybe to play the opposite of Devil's Advocate.
Which would just be an advocate.
Just be an advocate for my client, Brock Lesnar. Is it possible that since they're developing the two projects simultaneously, they're doing this to cover their bases? In other words, if the Shazam project falls apart, they'll at least have a backup with The Rock still attached while he's still a hot name.
That's a good point, but I would counter with, I don't know necessarily that I can buy into, from a narrative standpoint, a standalone Black Adam movie that has not been preceded by a Shazam movie that first introduces the character. Mm-hmm. You can't just have the character be an anti-hero from the jump. There has to be some sort of build to that point. I need to see him doing reprehensible things first before I am willing to believe that he does reprehensible things for a good cause.
Right. You need to see Black Adam before you can meet just Adam.
I suppose that's what I'm saying, but you know, I would not jump into a Black Adam movie without a Shazam movie that has already set up the character, is what I am saying.
A fair point.
And I am concerned that could wind up being the approach they ultimately take if some of these DC movies don't do as well as they, you know, as well as they're expected to do. Because I could easily see them saying, all right, we don't have faith in any of these characters in Batman at this point, but we know that The Rock has a proven box office draw, so let's scrap the Shazam movie and make the Black Adam movie instead. And I think that would be a wrong-headed approach.
Well, let me put this to you, Nick. What if they do that approach, but the villain in the Black Adam movie is Stone Cold Steve Austin?
Now that's a completely different thing, of course. That's a completely different. Oh my God, they should get the villain in the Black Adam standalone movie to be Stone Cold Steve Austin as the Music Meister, so he can just walk around singing the entire time.
What if the Music Meister and Black Adam sing a duet together?
Delta Dawn.
What's that flower you have on? Yep. Excellent.
Go ahead.
I'm sure all of our
fans
are enjoying that. Could it be a faded rose from days gone by?
Arm swing.
And did I hear you say he was meeting you here today?
And what you guys didn't see at home, and what I didn't see because I was looking at the other side of our Vancouver, British Columbian studios, Greg actually swung his arm down when he sang that last line. Yep.
Take you to his mansion in the sky.
And now he's waving his hand back and forth next to his mouth.
That just made the list.
I've seen this a time or two, if you can't, in case you couldn't tell.
And that just made the list too.
Jennifer's list is growing by the moment.
Anyway, let's much finish
like,
things up.
Much like those mercifully. People that were taking the elongated man's pills in Dark Knight Strikes Again. Hey-o.
Let's mercifully finish this thing off by staying in the DCEU film slate. And we're going to get to a little portion of the rundown that is Russell Sellers, our good friend Russell Sellers' favorite part of the rundown. Baseless speculation on almost assuredly false rumors.
Absolutely.
So, as we all know, the Green Lantern Corps movie is in development now, or at least it's in pre-development. Mm-hmm. We know what the premise is. We know it's going to have Hal Jordan and John Stewart. Well, now, everyone's favorite, ultra-reliable source, Umberto Gonzalez of The Wrap, has exclusively revealed.
Now, wait a minute. I feel a need for some clarification. And Jennifer, you should get your pen ready, by the way. Is this Umberto Gonzalez or is this Umberto Gonzalez Gonzalez?
Umberto Gonzalez Gonzalez was last seen helping run an orphanage with El Generico in Mexico. So he has not been seen in several years, but we do wish him the best. This is just Umberto Gonzalez.
Now, what about Jasper Stillwater St. Clair?
Jasper Stillwater St. Clair is currently the lead singer of a Neil Diamond cover band based in the Pittsburgh area. You know, he had a fall from grace, dealt with some alcoholism issues. However, we do believe that he's on the straight and narrow now. And I read on TMZ that he's actually thinking about trying to make a comeback with original music again.
And, of course, brother Eugene Otis?
No one's heard from him. He's been he went on a what he called a walkabout and hasn't been seen or heard from since. Although sometimes if you close your eyes, you can hear a foot tapping in the distance. And I've heard, especially in the area of New Mexico, that foot tapping in the distance can sometimes give way to the simple refrain of "Go ahead and kiss an ouch right there in front of you."
What about a yip? Has that been heard in some time?
Yips are heard every day in the greater Montgomery area at a certain advertising agency. So.
We
just made the list.
How far down the rabbit hole can we go tonight? Oh, God.
Unlistenable.
MySpace.com anyway. /Country Croon Boys.
Anyway, so Umberto here at The Wrap has given us an exclusive, quote, short list of actors DC Entertainment is considering pursuing for the role of Hal Jordan in Green Lantern Corps. Mm-hmm. Would you care to hear the list, ladies and gentlemen?
Oh, absolutely.
Should we give them the list?
I know that I would love to hear it, Greg.
Here is the list. The cast. Now, he does caution that the casting process is still in the very early stages, right. And there are no talks with any of the actors as of yet.
There's a lot of ins, a lot of outs, a lot of what have yous. I get it.
Right. These are the actors that DC is considering. Okay, are you ready? Here we go. I'm going to read them off in order.
Yes.
Do you want to read them off and then kind of discuss the choice?
Yeah, let's discuss each one as we go.
That's right. Let's just read them off here. Number one, we've got Tom Cruise, who would presumably play an aged version of Hal Jordan. Now, let me explain to you, and I can already hear, I can hear Nick's eyes rolling into the back of his head. But let me tell you why I think this is not the worst of ideas in the world. First of all, I and Nick and I are on opposite ends on Tom Cruise. I love action hero.
I was about to say, not Tom Cruise in general, a particular subset of the Tom Cruise catalog. That's where we differ.
Yes, I am a fan of the Tom Cruise action genre, if you will. I like him in action movies. Also, there is a school of thought that he would basically just be playing an older version of Maverick from Top Gun, a movie I don't like, but a character I can appreciate because of his similarities to Hal Jordan. Your thoughts, Nick?
Please, for the love of God, no. Please, no. No. I want to love this Green Lantern movie. I want to take it home and you know, introduce it to my parents. I don't want to be embarrassed and ashamed of it. I don't want it to be the crazy college girlfriend. No, God, no.
What you're saying is, Nick, you want to like this movie so much that you want to jump on Oprah's couch and scream, "I love this movie!"
Listen. We're just going to have to agree. I'm going to have to agree to disagree with the general public on Tom Cruise and hope and pray that Tom Cruise does not get this part, because it could be three years before the movie ever hits theaters, the equivalent of the Seinfeld gift for me. Well, see you later.
All right, let's move on to option number two. Joel McHale.
What? The soup guy?
The soup guy. From Community. And whatever that sitcom is on CBS. What a bizarre option.
You know, this makes me wonder. And now hear me out here. There could be a nugget of truth to this one. Let me explain. What if it's possible that old Umberto heard that Joel McHale was being considered for a role in Green Lantern Corps, and it's the bit role of Guy Gardner? I could see that.
Ooh! Now, yes, I could see him as Guy Gardner, yes. Although he would be kind of different from the jock style of Guy Gardner, but he could definitely play asshole Guy Gardner. Okay. But not Hal Jordan, right?
Not Hal Jordan. It would have to be Guy Gardner.
Okay. Number three, Bradley Cooper. Who is currently the voice of Rocket Raccoon in Marvel, which makes this highly unlikely, among other reasons that make it highly unlikely. But I'll say this, I could probably see it. I mean, it's not like when I think of Bradley Cooper, I don't think of Hal Jordan. But do I think he could play the character and play it well? Sure.
Right. Is this not the same exact casting list, though, that came out years ago for the Green Lantern movie? Wasn't Bradley Cooper on that list, too?
I feel like he was, yes. He was also on the Batman wannabe casting list.
Now, let me say for the record, by the way, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me say for the record, of the options that are presented on this list, I think this one is my favorite. Wait.
Really?
That's not true. Never mind. I take that back. It's my second favorite.
Okay.
I would be fine with this. I think there's literally zero chance of it happening because of the Rocket Raccoon thing and because of how bullshit this entire report is. But I would rank him...
Don't kill the illusion so quickly.
I would rank him number two on this hypothetical power ranking of these choices.
We'll come back to the power rankings in a second.
Okay.
I'm fine with it. I think Cooper is a damn good actor.
I generally like Bradley Cooper in most things I've seen him in.
Now.
He's got range. He can play a lovable asshole. He can play a douche. Like, there's... You know, I think he has more range than he's given credit for. And I think if they're going to go with the Lethal Weapon in Space, you know, take on it, there's going to have to be some strong comedy. And he's certainly a strong comedic actor.
Definitely. And I'll go ahead and say it. You can get lost in those eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, next up, perhaps the most controversial addition to this list, other than Joel McHale, I guess. And that would be the idea that because of his rejuvenated star in Hollywood, that Ryan Reynolds is actually being seriously considered to come back and play Hal.
I have no doubt that he is being seriously considered. Like, hey, wouldn't it be nice if we could get Ryan Reynolds back? I also have no doubt that Ryan Reynolds would never do this.
Would never do it. No.
Never.
I think this is probably the least likely, other than Joel McHale, the least likely of all these.
Is it
choices.
Less likely than Bradley Cooper?
I think so, actually.
Cooper is locked in to a major Marvel franchise right now.
Yeah. But it's one that he doesn't have to appear in live action, so.
True. But
Ryan Reynolds is locked into a major Fox franchise right now, so.
That's a good point. I'm just.
But I would say this. If it were to happen, I would have no issue with it.
None.
We've talked several times about how Ryan Reynolds is not the problem with the Green Lantern movie.
No.
I think that he likes the character a lot. I think he understands Hal. I think he could bring a little bit of a comedic edge to it, but balance it. I thought he did the best he could with some very subpar material in the Green Lantern movie.
I agree. I would not have an issue with this particular casting. However, again, to reemphasize, no chance this actually happens.
Not going to happen.
And two,
okay,
I don't really want it to happen.
All right.
And I don't want it to happen on. Because then you have the implication that the 2011 Green Lantern movie is canon for this universe. And I think it's best for all parties involved if that is not the case.
Yes, Parallax does not resemble one of my bowel movements, folks.
Right.
Now, let's move on to choice number 5, Armie Hammer.
Armie Hammer has been on every rumored... He has become the Nathan Fillion of DC Extended Universe films at this point, in that he's rumored for literally every DC role that ever comes up. One day, yes. I guess one day, like... The laws of percentages and averages dictate that one day he's actually going to get one, just, you know, by law of having been up for every role. But I don't understand the obsession with Armie Hammer. He was fine in The Social Network, but what?
And I liked him in what was the movie The Man from U.N.C.L.E. that he did with Henry?
Yeah, I haven't seen that, so yeah,
he was really good in that.
And I skipped Lone Ranger
again.
So.
Yeah, I did too. As did most of America. But I think that I guess where it comes down to on Armie Hammer is he was supposed to play Batman way back in the day when George Miller was going to do the Justice League movie. Okay, he's been rumored for seemingly every other DC role since then. And look, I'm not saying the guy's not good, but nothing about him says Hal Jordan to me. Like, and not just, I mean, looks, I don't really care about looks.
Right.
I'm going off of how they, you know, the acting and stuff. He's never, none of his roles that he's played to me have screamed Hal Jordan.
Just from a look standpoint, I would think Superman before I'd think Hal Jordan, but that's, you know.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah. Yep. So that's Armie Hammer. And now we've actually got two more names. One more name on this list. And there was another name that came out separate from this.
Let's do the separate one first.
Okay. The separate one came out, I believe, yesterday from another source that says that recent star, I believe, on Westworld, but most famous probably from the X-Men movies, Superman Returns, from a variety of comedies, James Marsden is actually a hot name in the Hal Jordan sweepstakes. Marsden, of course, famous for playing Cyclops in the X-Men movies. He played Lois's husband, boyfriend, in Superman Returns.
Cuckolded lover.
He's played phenomenally well, by the way, in several comedies in recent years. He almost kind of got born again as a comedic superstar in several like romantic comedies and just plain old comedies. And apparently is doing some good dramatic work on Westworld, from what I understand. I think it's Westworld.
He's on Westworld, which
not
in production.
But
right
Marsden is rumored for the role, and I'll say this is another one I would have no issue with if he were at. I've always liked James Marsden. I think that he didn't always get enough to do in the X-Men movies, but I've always enjoyed him. And I think he could bring a little bit of that humor to the Hal Jordan role that needs to be there. What are your thoughts on Marsden?
Remember the Blog of Doom, how we used to talk about the Cody line?
Mm-hmm.
The Marsden line. Like, that's...
The Marsden
like,
line.
I have no opinion. I have no strong feeling. It would elicit neither a cheer nor a boo from me. I would just be like, well, I guess that's a thing. And then I'd move on about my day.
Sure. No, that's fair. That's fair. And we'll do our rankings here in a minute. But I think that's a fair reaction to have. It would be fine, in my opinion. It wouldn't set my world on fire necessarily. But I think he could knock it out of the park, potentially. He'd have the potential to come in and give a really good showing. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. But, I'm kind of with you on that one. I would have no issues with it. I'll put it that way. Now, let's wrap it up with the last name on the list, and that is Jake Gyllenhaal, who has been in so many movies I can't even begin to name them. One of Nick's favorite movies, of course, being Zodiac, that had Jake Gyllenhaal in it. But he's been in a litany of things throughout the last 15, 20 years. Nick, I have a feeling you have thoughts on this.
Yes, please. I would be all over this. Like, in terms of a guy who has probably, at this point in their career, in terms of variety of roles that they take, I think he has more range than anybody else on this list. I think he can do comedy. I think he can do drama. I think he can do the action stuff. I think he's the most versatile performer on this list. I think he is probably at this point, next to Cooper and Cruz, the biggest names on this list that would provide a little bit of that box office buzz. I love everything about this, and it makes me that much more upset. This is a completely bullshit report that has no chance of ever coming true. Because, you know, you've asked me before, like, you know, your dream Green Lantern casting, and if you take away Chris Pine, who has always been my dream Hal Jordan since I first saw Star Trek in 2009.
As he should be.
Yeah. Right, and if you take him off the table, if you assume that they're not going to have him as both Steve Trevor and Hal Jordan, which I guess is technically possible, if you assume they're not going to do that and you take him off the table, I've always struggled to come up with a number two choice, and I hate Umberto Gonzalez for even putting the thought of Jake Gyllenhaal into my head, because now it makes me really upset that it's never going to happen.
Yeah, I would like this choice too. I think Gyllenhaal's a guy who I think should be in the superhero movie genre at some point. And it's kind of a shame that he hasn't been. I know he did Prince of Persia a few years ago,
right.
A little bit different. But he deserves a franchise like this to be part of.
Right.
Not that these other guys don't. But it would be a really cool thing to see.
He's just a guy who can do anything. Like, I think it doesn't mean that he always is successful with whatever role he takes, but I think he has proven over the course of his career that he can take a variety of different roles and be successful, you know, and doesn't get pigeonholed into being just an action guy or just a dramatic guy or just a comedy guy. He can do, you know, essentially everything. Kind of like James Franco. I feel that way about him too, but, you know, obviously he's not under consideration on this bold list.
Yes. All right, so I'm looking at the list right now. I'm trying to come up with my
rankings. List of seven.
Just off the top.
Yep.
Yep. And,
I can go.
You go ahead, Nick. You go first.
What, 7-1 or 1-7?
Go 7-1.
7-1. 7. Tom Cruise.
Oh.
What?
Are we trading countdowns?
No, I'm
here?
Going 7, Tom Cruise. 6, Joel McHale. 5, right. I'm going to go Armie Hammer. 4, I'm going to go James Marsden. 3, Ryan Reynolds. 2, Bradley Cooper. And 1, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Pretty close to mine. Pretty close. Not exactly, but pretty close. I'm going to go 7. Joel McHale. I'm going to go 6, Armie Hammer. I'm going to go 5, Tom Cruise.
Wow, that's stunning to me. Stunning.
Why is that stunning?
It's stunning to me because you've always vehemently defended the guy whenever I've rolled my eyes at Jack Reacher or Night and Day or any of the other bullshit action roles he's taken over the last 10 years.
Oh, come on. Listen, no, I defend Tom Cruise, but listen, we're talking about when you're looking at this list of people, who do I think of when I think Hal Jordan, and I'm giving you my list.
Although, Greg, there is something to be said for his ability to make you – to really convey that he actually believes in this bullshit science fiction.
We're not here to talk about that. That's a whole nother – another box of words. Listen, I'm not defending the man's personal viewpoints. I'm defending his acting skills. As you know, Nick, I am a fan of several actors who have questionable personal views.
You sure do, sugar tits.
Oh, boy. Anyway, so I'll put Cruise at 5 because I just don't see him as Hal Jordan personally. But who knows? Now, here's where it gets hard for me. At number 4... At number 4, I'm going to go James Marsden. At number 3, I'm going to go – ooh, this is tough. At number 3, I'm going to go Okay, yeah. At number three, I'm going to go Ryan Reynolds. Mm-hmm. At number two, I'm going to go, and this is a shock from even what I said earlier, because and at number one, I'm going to go Bradley Cooper, because the more I think about it, again, not that it has any chance of happening, but I could, yeah, I'm picturing it right now, and I could see Bradley Cooper have a kind of the moxie of kind of an arrogant Hal Jordan type role, you know?
So you're going Cooper over Gyllenhaal, just to clarify.
Yes, Cooper over Gyllenhaal, but both high on my list, obviously. Both at the top. So, very good. I feel like that was a productive conversation, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get off topic that much. We didn't delve into our wrestling references too much, except for the Cody line and a few other times.
Yeah, but the Cody line was used to make a valid point in the course of the discussion. For clarification, just to go
That's
back,
true.
The Cody line is like, imagine the definition of average. Like, and not saying that I feel that way about Cody Rhodes as a performer, but at one point, that was the term that was used, yes. Is that the squarely in the middle, you know.
Yep.
And that's kind of how I am with Marsden. Now, granted, I haven't seen Westworld, which I've heard is amazing. I want to see Westworld. It sounds right up my alley. It's based on a Michael Crichton joint. It's all the things that should speak to me, but I just have not carved out the time just yet. So I may have different feelings after finally seeing Westworld.
Well, why we can't watch Southworld first?
Well, you know, that's I don't know. I don't know why that is, because we live in Southworld, Greg. We currently live in... Never mind. Never mind. Nope.
yep. But in any event, folks, who would you like to see play Hal Jordan? And let's be honest, anyone you throw out there, as long as they are living, is just as likely as anyone that Umberto Gonzalez threw out there in this article, by the way. So who would you like to see play Hal Jordan? Let us know. Contact us on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Contact us on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just go into your search bar and type in Place to Be Nation Comics. You'll pull us up. Join the group. We'll let you in. A lot of fun discussion there. And or let us know through email. GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com, all one word. Let us know your thoughts on who should play Green Lantern. What are your thoughts on The Dark Knight Strikes Again? Were we wrong on it? Is it actually a secret masterpiece that we're sitting on here? Were we not hard enough on it? Let us know.
Hard.
Or anything else that we talked about in this episode, let us know. I know that for both Nick and I, our dream casting for Hal Jordan, as we mentioned, has always been Chris Pine. Mm-hmm. That appears to be off the table, but, you know, you can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need.
Yep, unless that is – but then sometimes it also turns out to be the 2011 Green Lantern movie, so, you know.
No, that's true. I mean, we could very well still end up with Jack Black as Hal Jordan.
Oh, God.
So,
oof.
You know, it's
– crisis averted.
Anything is possible.
Crisis averted.
Do you think, Nick, that we could start our own site where we start off hot Hollywood rumors?
Yeah, I think we could. I think we could. You pretty much just start with, like, a bunch of pre-written stories about Nathan Fillion, and then you just fill in, like, a superhero role there. That's pretty much how you get the buzz amongst the fan base. You build up the goodwill because they'll think that we're touting Nathan Fillion for all these superhero roles, and then we just start making up whatever the hell we want.
Right.
Now, remember, in anything we report, or the beauty of whatever we report would be that they wouldn't be falsehoods. They would be alternative facts.
That's right, alternative facts. And we'd have to learn how to use the couching language in these articles, such as sources close to the situation. Nothing's official yet.
Which we're already there. I mean, if we just fill the article with a bunch of JR-isms, I think we'll be safe. You know, some might say.
Some might say. It's not for us to say right now. But then again, it could go the other way.
Certainly a unique situation again, right now.
Yep, some might disagree.
Mm-hmm.
Just a lot of vagaries that could still be thrown in there.
Vagaries, what a good word.
It is a good word. Thank you, vagaries. But what is not vague is our continued commitment to our listening audience. So let us know in your feedback what you'd like to hear on the show, what you'd like to see on the show. You're not going to see our ugly faces, I can promise you that. No video podcast coming soon. Let us know what we can do to make the show better. Nick, what do we have coming up for the folks in the next few weeks?
Yes, so coming up next week, we will, of course, be debuting our first show of the month of February. And for that first week, as is now our custom, we will once again be bringing you another installment of the Hard Travelers for Hire series, this time bringing on our official Captain America correspondent, Tim Capel, to take a look at the first Captain America movie, Captain America: The First Avenger. Very excited to look back at that one, as it's one that I have mentioned before. Seems to be the Phase 1 Marvel movie that has improved the most over time in subsequent rewatches for me. I know you don't necessarily feel that way about it, so I'm interested to get your take on a rewatch of that next week. And then the rest of February will be filled up. You know, we kind of had Hate Month in January, and we're balancing that out during the month of February with Love Month, in which we will be taking a look at three shows themed around things that we just absolutely love. And of course, that'll all get started with a long book hunt on what we both consider to be the greatest Green Lantern story of all time. And that is, of course, the Sinestro Corps War. We will be taking a very special look at that in the second week of February. We'll be following that up with a look at what Greg and I both consider to be the finest DC animated movie ever made, Batman Under the Red Hood. And then we will be wrapping that the month of February up. You know, in the month of January, our countdown was our bottom five DC stories of all time. So in the month of February, we're going to bring you our top five Marvel stories ever. So should be interesting to see how that list shakes out.
Very much so. And hopefully you guys will be here for all of those and enjoy our show and enjoy some of the guests that we have coming on in the next few months. But in the bottom of my heart, thank you for listening. It really means a lot to us that you take the time out of your day to listen to us ramble and tell inside jokes and all that stuff. Thank you so much for listening to all of our episodes. And it means a lot to us when you reach out to us and let us know how you feel. So tell us how we can get better, and we'll try to do better and be here for you next time and every week in the future, as we're already past the 40-episode mark. I can't believe it. So
We're rapidly approaching the both the 50th episode and the one-year anniversary. So we got some pretty big milestones coming up in the coming months, and we have some things on tap to celebrate those occasions that we will be talking about in the very near future.
Indeed. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we bid you adieu.
There's gonna be some trouble tonight. A very royal rumble.
That's right.
We'll step into the ring. We'll reach an understanding. When the smoke is clear, I'll be the last man standing. I'm gonna settle every score tonight. They'll take back every word they said tonight. I'm gonna show the door to every saint or sinner. There can only be one Royal Rumble winner.
That's not the rumble I had in mind.
WWE Royal Rumble, live Sunday, January 30th, only on pay-per-view.